This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while vetted by residents, is not personally verified by our hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts in these topics. The content provided in this podcast and in any linked materials is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We try to stay away from opinions, but all opinions represented are our own and out of the University Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy the podcast.
Welcome
to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast over here on the Vanderbilt side with JP. So jumping right into it, there's never been a lab that's been as helpful and as cryptic as the lactate or the lactic acidosis. But I heard Griffin gave us a great presentation trying to clarify some of this.
He did. Sorry, making me laugh with as helpful or as cryptic. Because yes, lactic and lactic acidosis can definitely be one of those incredibly helpful markers when you have a cause for lactic acidosis. But it can also, you know, make you scratch your head when you don't have a clear cause of why the lactate's elevated. So going over the basics of why lactate is produced, Griffin did a great job of dividing this. It's sort of the lactate is that mid-step between glycolysis and Krebs cycle. Glycolysis, when glucose gets internalized into the cell, phosphorylated, and goes all the way down to pyruvate. If there is enough oxygen and pyruvate dehydrogenase is working, that's oxidative phosphorylation. So if pyruvate goes down that pathway, that's Krebs, you get oxidative phosphorylation. However, if something's impeding Krebs cycle, so if the pyruvate dehydrogenase isn't functioning appropriately, like in thiamine deficiency, or if you don't have any oxygen, then you can't activate Krebs. If you can't activate Krebs, then all that pyruvate will turn to lactate. And that's the typical scenario with a lactic acidosis that we call a type A, which is basically tissue hypoxia that results in an increased anaerobic metabolism. He mentioned that whenever we have lactate accumulation, which is worth discussing, it's either decreased clearance or increased production. There's actually a fair amount of lactate that's produced every day at baseline by all of us. He quoted a number about 1,300 millimoles per day. And this is from normal metabolism in erythrocytes, muscle. And this is metabolized, about 60 to 70% of it gets metabolized by the liver, and 30 to 40% of it gets metabolized by the kidney. So this is where it gets a little bit more complex. And Griffin did a really good job of just basically saying, okay, do you have a change in clearance? Do you have a change in production? And what's the actual cause for this elevated lactate? The type B lactic acidosis, we can further subdivide it into B1, sort of a medical condition. So what are these medical conditions? And again, it's part of the laundry list of things: liver disease, malignancy, renal dysfunction, diabetes, and even pheos, right? So pheochromocytoma will make your lactate go up. Type B2, which is drugs or toxins. And here we discuss metformin, cyanide toxicity, ethanol, other toxic alcohols such as methanol. Type B3 is sort of the inborn errors of metabolism, which, you know, our friends on the PED side see a lot more commonly than we do. On medicine, we tend to not see these inborn errors of metabolism. Griffin did a really good job when he focused from this lactic acidosis to a very particular type of lactic acidosis associated to toxic alcohols. And he narrowed down on propylene glycol. 20,000-foot view, toxic alcohols, they're basically going to get metabolized by the same two enzymes. You get your toxic alcohol, whatever you want it to be, right? Ethylene glycol, methanol, propylene glycol, diethylene glycol, isopropanol. All of these are going to be metabolized first by alcohol dehydrogenase and then by aldehyde dehydrogenase. There's obvious exceptions. But in these two steps, so alcohol dehydrogenase first and aldehyde dehydrogenase second, you're going to get these intermediate metabolites. And in particular, with propylene glycol, you go from propylene glycol to lactaldehyde and then to lactate plus hydrogen ion. So basically, what you're getting with propylene glycol is a lactic acidosis directly related to the ingestion of propylene glycol. So propylene glycol toxicity will mimic the effects of ethanol on the CNS. You can get ataxia, dysarthria, confusion. You'll get hyperosmolar state secondary to, similar to what you get with every toxic alcohol, and a lactic acidosis. Now, so you can also have associated hypotension, seizures, and even intravascular hemolysis. There's some references for acute renal failure. That tends to be more on the rare side. The three things that you need to consider with propylene glycol is that it mimics the ethanol CNS effects, right? So ataxia, dysarthria, and confusion. It's going to be a hyperosmolar state, and you're going to have lactic acidosis. What medications use propylene glycol? Because this is a big teaching point, right? Propylene glycol we use to dilute medications. So if we give these medications enough, we will give our patients propylene glycol toxicity. So what are they? Mainly benzos, right? So diazepam and lorazepam. By volume, they have about 40% and 80% propylene glycol.
What other ones? Esmolol, phenytoin, nitroglycerin, digoxin, etomidate, and phenobarbital. But the big ones are diazepam and lorazepam. Keep in mind, we could be causing a propylene glycol toxicity just by the medications that we're giving our patients. So in summary, lactic acidosis is often multifactorial, and it can be directly related to tissue hypoxia, but it can also be related to other things, right? Remember the clearance production paradigm. Lactic acidosis associated to tissue hypoxia is the type A, and that's because we have a predominance of anaerobic metabolism. And then we have all the other causes in type B, and this is where we have the B1, B2, and B3 subtypes. Generally, what you have to think of there are the medical conditions, liver failure, renal failure, and medications, drugs, toxins as a source of lactate.
All right, JP, something that we see very often here in the hospital, whether it be real or not, is we see GPCs growing back in the blood cultures. Sometimes clinically, we think that's not real, but when we do think it's real, and specifically Staph aureus, it raises the question of what should we do with it? And I heard Rob gave us a great presentation trying to clarify what we're doing here.
He did. So Rob discussed Staph aureus bacteremia in general, and he went over some of the basics about Staph aureus as a bug itself, right? The production of toxins, the exfoliative toxins, A and B, the heat stable enterotoxin, the antiphagocytic effect that actually Staph aureus can have, which protects us from the immune system, as well as the spreading, right? The fact that it produces hyaluronidase and it helps the spreading through the body because it can actually, well, basically chew through tissue. He also discussed the antibiotic resistance. He discussed the beta-lactamase production in the MEK-A gene and how this made Staph aureus one of those bacteria, and particularly methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, that we have to treat, and we have to treat quickly and appropriately. And how does that look like in the hospital? Well, basically, it means an infectious disease consultation. He showed an interesting paper which showed that in patients that had gotten an infectious disease consultation, basically, they had better outcomes. And he narrowed it down to the essential principles of if you have a patient that has Staph aureus bacteremia, everyone should get IV antibiotics, everybody should get an echocardiogram, everybody should be asked about back pain, everybody should get surveillance cultures, and everyone should get an infectious disease consult. If the patient has MRSA, antibiotic that's indicated is vancomycin, right? He discussed how Redman syndrome is not a true allergy. Redman syndrome is a rate-dependent hypersensitivity reaction related to mast cell activation. So if someone has Redman syndrome, you can pre-medicate them with antihistamines, particularly Benadryl, and you can use a slower rate of infusion. Again, Redman syndrome is not a true allergy to vancomycin, and vancomycin is a preferred therapy for MRSA bacteremia. MSSA gets a little bit more complicated in terms of antibiotic choice, particularly because it seems that all beta-lactams aren't the same in terms of treatment. Ultimately, if your patient has Staph aureus, be it MSSA or MRSA, we need to get ID involved so that they help guide the management for that particular patient.
All right, JP, I heard we had two good morning reports on a topic that, as internal medicine residents, we know pretty well, hypothyroidism and hyperthyroidism. But Ryan and Ted, I heard, took us to the extremes of hypothyroidism with myxedema coma and hyperthyroidism with Graves' disease. Can you fill me in on that?
Of course I can. Yeah, they gave us some really interesting presentations where they talked about basic thyroid physiology and then the extremes of what happens when you don't have thyroid hormones, and then what happens when you have an excess of thyroid hormones. So let's review some of the basics before we start discussing some of the pathophysiology. So thyroid hormones, or the thyroid axis, is going to be regulated by thyroid releasing hormones, so the TRH. TRH is going to be produced in the hypothalamus. That's going to go down into the pituitary. You're going to produce TSH, the thyroid stimulating hormone. TSH is then going to go into the thyroid gland mainly. There's receptors for TSH elsewhere, but mainly into the thyroid gland. And it's going to activate the production of T3 and T4. Activation of production of T3 and T4 is going to be, so this iodine is the key component in all this. The metabolic pathway for the production of the thyroid hormones is going to be 7 steps, a lot of which are regulated by the thyroid peroxidase, or TPO. And that's important. That's the one enzyme that we need to know about. So when the T3 and T4 get secreted into the systemic circulation, they're going to be highly protein bound, more than 99% for both of them. Why is this important? That means that their half-life is long. If there's something is protein-bound, half-life is long. So as you have these circulating normal T3 and T4 hormones, once they hit the target tissues, T4 is going to be converted from T4 to active T3 in the peripheral tissues. And Ted mentioned that that happens by a monodiiodinase, which basically removes one iodine from the outer ring of the thyroid hormone. And this T3, which was converted from T4 in the peripheral tissue, is what has an effect. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the excess of thyroid hormones because it's a little bit easier to understand. So when we're talking about what the functions are, we can catalog them by increasing metabolic rate, increasing metabolism, and increasing cardiac output. So basically, you are revving up every system in the body. How does this happen? There's a change in sodium potassium ATPase for one. There's an increased synthesis of sodium potassium ATPase, and there's an increased synthesis of beta adrenergic receptors. So if you increase the synthesis of beta adrenergic receptors, you're going to get an increase overall in metabolism together with this increase in sodium potassium ATPase. Again, oversimplified, but that's the gist of it. So when someone has Graves' disease, what you're going to get is a non-lytic antibody that mimics TSH. So Ted was explaining that you get an antibody, so it's an IgG, that will stimulate the TSH receptor in the absence of TSH. So what happens in terms of the axis when you have something that is like TSH but is not TSH, stimulating the thyroid? So one, you will have thyroid stimulation, which means that the thyroid will be churning out T3 and T4. The feedback loop to the brain will mean that the TRH and the TSH are going to be suppressed. So TSH should be low to undetectable. So what are the effects of having this excess thyroid hormone circulating around? If we said that you increase your metabolism, you're going to get tachycardic, tremor, physical exam findings, right? So lid lag, when you're able to see, this is going to be non-technical, right? But when you ask a patient to look up and then look down, as they follow your finger down, you should not be able to see the white of their eyes between the eyelid and the iris. If you do, then that's called lid lag. Other clinical manifestations other than the palpitations, as we said, so the increased heart rate, they can have arrhythmias and particularly atrial fibrillation, which can happen because they have excess thyroid hormones. They can have weight loss. They can have changes in their menstrual cycle, particularly with young women. And the, you know, typical physical exam finding for Graves, which is Graves' exophthalmopathy. So and why does this happen? So it turns out that it's not directly related to T3 and T4. But there are fat pads that have a TSH receptor in the orbits. So as this TSH receptor gets stimulated by the Graves antibody, then that starts generating tissue, which will then make the eyes bulge out. That's sort of the typical exam finding. They can also have goiter. So as the thyroid starts producing more T3 and T4, if this is sort of later on in the disease, you can have goiter. So in these patients, what's the treatment? Well, first, you're going to have to treat the symptoms. Typically, you start them on propranolol, which is a sort of non-selective alpha-beta blocker, to get rid of some of the symptoms. And then you have to decide between methimazole and propylthiouracil, or PTU. And this is where you get your endocrine colleagues to weigh in specifically on what the treatment is going to be to get the patient out of this acute Graves state. But in general, sort of the overall therapy is get rid of the symptoms, give them propranolol, start them either on methimazole or PTU, and then transition to a more definitive form of therapy. And the two that we discussed were thyroidectomy, which is basically just removing the entire thyroid and supplementing thyroid hormones, and radioactive iodine ablation. So you give them radioactive iodine, which will hopefully concentrate in the thyroid, ablate the tissue, and then you medically manage the hypothyroidism. So that's Graves. On the other end of the spectrum, Ryan discussed myxedema coma, which is basically what happens when you have no thyroid tissue, right? So what is myxedema coma? It's a state of decompensated hypothyroidism. So if you don't have thyroid hormones, what you're going to end up having is a decreased metabolism. Well, there's two clinical scenarios when it tends to happen. Again, well, let's start off. This is a rare disease. The incidence about 0.2 cases per million per year. And the two clinical scenarios when it happens is long-standing undiagnosed hypothyroidism that can be precipitated by an acute event, untreated hypothyroidism that then has some sort of stressor which would require an increased metabolic activity and it doesn't happen, or patients that stop their thyroid supplementation. Why is it important to talk about myxedema coma? Because the mortality rate is 20 to 50%. So what are the precipitating factors? Ryan mentioned several, right? So infection, myocardial infarction, strokes, PE, seizures, GI hemorrhage. So basically what you're seeing there is just situations that increase metabolic stress. Interestingly enough, she also commented that hypothermia during winter months can precipitate it. Surgery in and of itself can precipitate myxedema coma. And then medications. She mentioned opiates, particularly different types of anesthetics, general anesthetics. Amiodarone, as we all know, there's some thyroid toxicity associated with amiodarone. But if a patient is at risk for myxedema coma, amiodarone could potentially do it. And diuretics. In the evaluation and diagnosis for myxedema, you're going to need sort of clinical history potential of hypothyroidism together with altered mental status and then a box of 16 called the hypos. So you could potentially have hypotension, hypoxemia, hypothermia, hyponatremia, hypoventilation, hypoglycemia. So what's the workup? You're going to do the basic workup that we do for patients that are critically ill, CBC, CMP. In the CBC, you can see basically pancytopenia associated to a lack of thyroid hormone stimulation from the on the bone marrow. And then if you see the TSH, free T4, thyroid antibodies, basically what you're trying to figure out is what is their thyroid function in this current state. EKG, low voltage, prolonged QTC, decreased heart rate. So again, what you're seeing are the hallmarks of a decreased metabolic activity. So what is the treatment? Intensive care, most of the time they're going to need to be on the vent. Steroid supplementation, if required, that means that they could also be adrenally insufficient. You need to rewarm them externally. The problem being that if you do internal rewarming and they have vasodilatation, they could also get hypotensive and then you add it on, second cause of shock. And then thyroid hormone replacement, right? This is where you get your endocrine colleagues because there's not a consensus in terms of exactly how we should give the T4 or T3. But basically, if they have a lack of thyroid hormones, we need to give them thyroid hormones. The two that she mentioned, where free T4 as an IV infusion, but again, there was some variation in the doses and the timing of T4 versus T3 or giving them together. So basically, the take-home message is diagnose it, get endocrine on board early so that they can help you manage these patients.